Markets react to airstrikes in Yemen. From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update. After the mess on the stock market yesterday, with the Dow falling nearly 300 points, in early trading on Thursday, the Dow was down again about 0.5% for the S&P 500, down about 0.3%, a little bit worse in early trading for the NASDAQ Composite Index. Then there's oil with the Saudi-led airstrikes against rebels in Yemen. About a half hour into stock trading, the key Texas price was up about 3% to around $50.46 a barrel. Now, Yemen produces just 0.2% of the world's oil. Diane Swonk is chief economist at Mesirow Financial in Chicago.
Well, the issue is whether or not it hits the we see war spillover into larger producers like Saudi Arabia, where all the oil really is, a lot of oil in the world. And so the issue is, you know, what oversupply can give us, war can take away.
The use of military force like this prompts players to take some risk out of their portfolios, Swonk says.
What we're seeing is a lot of uncertainty about what is going on in the Middle East. What does it mean for oil prices going forward? What does it mean for the global economy going forward? And so it affects everything from bond yields to oil prices to equity prices. People are uncertain about what profits will be in a world where we don't know the course of oil.
Economist Diane Swonk. In college, we study a phenomenon called regulatory capture, where government regulators absorb the values and get all palsy with the industries they regulate. Capture gets some of the blame for the great financial collapse more than 5 years ago, but a prominent Wall Street lawyer, H. Rajan Cohen, told a banking law conference in Phoenix the other day that he doesn't see capture. He sees the opposite these days, which he thinks is a problem. I spoke to him from his office in New York. Mr. Cohen, good morning.
My pleasure.
Now, you think that this idea of regulatory capture is a myth? How so?
I think it is a myth because, from my experience, the front line of the regulators approaches their job with both independence and with a healthy degree of skepticism. But when spokespeople continuously criticize the examiners, it inevitably demoralizes them and makes the examiners almost inevitably draw back and not act collaboratively, but with suspicion.
What do you think led to this, you know, from your point of view, this almost poisoned atmosphere? Do you think it was the revelations last year, that ProPublica reporting about the New York Fed, which regulates Wall Street firms? There was a sense from some audio tapes that emerged that the regulators there seemed awfully friendly to the company that was being regulated. Do you think that was the catalyst for this?
I don't know whether it was the catalyst. It seems to me it was one of a number of contributing factors. To try and suggest that it was regulatory capture that was responsible for 2008, it was not the regulators were turning their head. Mistakes were made, and there were some bad actors. There's no question about it. So it was a stream into which there were many tributaries that led to this situation.
You're arguing that the great financial collapse was not a failure of regulation. I mean, you understand why people would draw that conclusion, because things did go awry. We do have regulators, but you're saying it wasn't the regulators.
The mistakes were in the institutions which got into so much trouble. Yes, the regulators in some cases should have caught it earlier. In some cases, though, it was the overall legislative scheme where a large number of players were very lightly, if at all, regulated. So there were failures of individual regulators, there were failures of the regulatory scheme, but those were contributing factors, not the cause. If there is a recognition that the regulators are effective for the most part, and an understanding of cooperation is a hallmark of the examination process, I think we get better exams, better banks, a stronger, ultimately, economy.
H. Rajan Cohen is senior chairman of the law firm Sullivan & Cromwell. Mr. Cohen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Starting today, Marketplace and the New York Times are exploring financial lessons learned by artists, newsmakers, and even marketplace personnel like Kai, Lizzie, and myself. The collaboration is called My Biggest Financial Lesson. As part of this now, here is one of the most famous women of underground rock with a reflection about wants and needs.
I'm Kim Gordon, and I'm an artist and founder of the band Sonic Youth. When I was growing up, I think my parents gave me $10 as a clothing allowance. My mother grew up in the Depression, so she never bought clothes that were new. She bought clothes in thrift stores, or she made clothes. It made me a little neurotic about buying clothes, actually. I mean, I still feel sort of weird about, like, buying an expensive designer bag or something. Like, I guess I've had that given to me every now and then or once. Playing in a band for years, you know, you just get money in kind of lumps, you know, when you go on tour or something like that. I never quite know what the parameters of my income is or how stable it is. I guess what I learned is if you wait, you know, and if you really think about it, then maybe it's worth going back and getting. But most things you really don't need.
Find Kim Gordon's audio essay and financial lessons learned by others in today's New York Times Your Money special section, newyorktimes.com, and online at marketplace.org. The piece I have in the Times today has a sobering projection of what my face is supposed to look like when I'm old. Older, I should say. Economist Diane Swank just texted from Chicago with what I think is pity. Well, at least you still have your hair, she texted. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.